Well, for any plagiarists in the audience, I gather that the book we're going to describe is actually going to be published today. So it's bad news for some potential plagiarists. But at any rate, this subject was introduced to me a long time ago by Darrell Holm, who I think was one of the inventors of this field. And I'll put a bit on the screen about the background of it. The method was advertised as a way of dealing with sub-grid scales in simulations. The perennial problem of simulation is how to deal with scales that you can't resolve on the computer. And the method that was devised is a somewhat intricate one. It was set up by using a method, the hybrid Eulerian-Lagrangian method, which Andrew's going to describe a little bit. And this leads you to two variables instead of one for the, not just the velocity. You have a kind of mean velocity set up in that equation in the middle of the screen. And you can see from that equation that the properties of the two functions are that the B bar tends to be an average, as the bar suggests, because clearly, if you solve that equation in terms of some sort of Green's function, you would see that the V bar is a kind of average of the V. And it is, in a sense, some sort of average representation of the subgrid scales. Now, several people have tried using this, and with moderate success. Chris and I published a paper in which we used the method, and I would say that it was probably as good as other methods of resolving subgrid scales, such as adding enhanced diffusion to the smaller scales, or by adding hyperviscosity, or anything like that. And this, I think, encouraged Darrell Holm to devise this method of justifying the approximation. And this got us interested in this area because some of the predictions were quite extraordinary. One particularly was that Kelvin's theorem was, a form of Kelvin's theorem was still true for this system of equations. And this is a somewhat a surprising thing, even though I should explain something about the terminology, that you call it a Navier-Stokes alpha equation, but in the first instance, it's taken from the Navier-Stokes equation without the viscosity. We think that it would be better called an Euler alpha equation, but the name's now stuck. It's always called the Navier-Stokes alpha equation, but it has been used for turbulence simulations as well, where Darrell and his friends have added, in an ad hoc sort of way, a viscosity term to the equations. Well, that's really the start. The talk's going to be given in a sort of representative a proportion of the amount of work we did on the on this together. So I'm going to hand over to. Where's that guy? They're on the ship.
Intelligent cross before I begin. Right. One of the problems we had in preparing these pictures was that we weren't clear how to get the figures in, so I think I'll actually begin with actually writing a few things on the board. Ah, can we screen the... It's a funny business, this, because in some sense what I'm talking about, I've had something to do with it for a very long time, and in fact soon after doing my PhD I was involved with doing this sort of work. And I think it might be helpful to come in at the beginning, as it were, because the sort of things we're interested in are things like, if you've got a magnetic field line, and say you've got magnetic field line C, and suppose they're uniform, then supposing you have some sort of wave motion going on, then you could imagine these magnetic field lines being distorted into waves like that. You can also envisage a mean flow going on as well. You can have a flow parallel to these field lines, and you can envisage the whole system forming a wave-like motion. So you have a mean flow, then you have waves riding on that mean flow. And the issue is how are you going to deal with a wave type of turbulence which is riding on a mean flow and has a persistent magnetic field in it. And if you're in the high conductivity limit, one of the things that is quite helpful in MHD is to use Alfvén's frozen field theorem and think of the magnetic field line as frozen to the fluid flow. And one of the first problems you're then faced with is how to deal with the waves that you've got riding on this mean flow. I mean, if you take a magnetic field and you then move it, you can talk about the fluid coming from initial position X and finishing up at a final position XL, and you know what the field line's done. You can relate the field at the new positions XL to the field you had originally. Now, the problem you have in this case is, in a sense, how you want to deal with it is slightly different. You don't want to follow the fluid particles, because if the fluid is moving along here, fluid that starts there, as time proceeds, this particle moves to there, down to there, wandering all over the place. And you've got, if you take some sort of Lagrangian point of view, you'd start there and you'd finish up over here. And that's not the worst of your problems. If the thing is shearing, you have a coordinate system here which is nice grid like so. By the time it's got over here, it's looking like that. By the time it's got over here, it's sort of really looking like that, and it's the right mess. So you want to have a technique for avoiding that horrible business. And what you do is, instead of tracking the fluid particles, you imagine, if you like, a fictitious flow. You imagine a flow which isn't real at all, but is convecting particles. Well, not particles, but fictitious particles. So instead of going all the way over there, you'd start off at some point, and you'd just go a short distance. So you'd start off at X, and you'd move to another point, XL, say. And the way to think about this in the first instance is to say, we've got our magnetic field line here. We want to have a representation of how it's distorted. What we want to do is, in sense, we know the field is moving with the fluid. What we really want to do is not to track particles, which is what you do in a Lagrangian point. You don't want to track the particles, you want to track lines. So the idea is, as the fluid moves, this line becomes another line. You want to track the line. You don't want to track the material points. So the natural way of doing this is just to identify the point on that field with the point you started with. It's not the real position that you've moved to. It's just the point on that line. So what you're doing is, I think this is the simplest way to think about it in the first instance, you want a mapping which takes you from one line to another, one curve to another curve, not from individual points to individual points, in the sense of following the Lagrangian path of a particle. So that's really the starting point for the sort of, if you like, hybrid Eulerian-Lagrangian point of view. It's the point of view I adopted when I was looking at Baginski's dynamo in back in the early 70s. I also wrote down the appropriate equations of motion which come out of this formalism. And this predates the work that Andrews and McIntyre did later. However, their formalism, I did all the stuff in cylindrical polar coordinates, which is a terrible mess. It's a slightly different problem. And also, the dynamical side was not something that I focused on, and those other guys did a lot more. But the basic idea we're after here is to use this local representation. So you can think of this is going to be good for something like wave turbulence. If you've got something where waves are riding up and down on the flow, it's going to work well. It's not going to work well if fluid particles move a long way apart, because if a fluid particle starts here and moves over there, and another one starts there and moves over there, this sort of idea isn't going to be very helpful. It's only helpful if they all stay bunched together, like some sort of wave clustering. So that's the essential idea. And well, I wouldn't have thought so. Not this hypothesis, anyway. Or keep chaotic. I mean, you can wave chaos, but not real chaos. No, because the whole way this works is you do expansions assuming you've got a small displacement. It's not been entering my thinking.
Yes. It works when you have a mean flow and a fluctuating velocity. It may be chaotic, but it's weak compared to the mean flow.
Yeah, that would be all right. Yeah. But I think you've got to be a bit careful about that. If there's some sort of mean drift, I suppose it would be all right, as long as there's no... As long as the particles aren't separating, you've got to watch what that V prime's doing, haven't you? Well, let's see how the theory develops, and perhaps that's a later question. I suppose I would be that way inclined. If you've got lines built into the system, yeah, I'd be happier with magnetic field lines, I think. And I like the picture that I've started with is the one I feel happiest with, put it that way. The question's sort of so oblique to the way I'm thinking at the moment. I don't see that as the issue. I mean, okay, I think that's probably enough of a preamble. You can see where we're trying to head towards. We set up some of the formalism. I know some of you because you said this to me. You've looked at the paper that Paul and I wrote for JFM. It's absolutely full of variational stuff. I'm not going to talk much about the variational side of it today. The variational work we did in that paper was a nightmare. And we sort of really got pushed into it by one of the referees that said, you really need to pin down where the home has gone wrong. And so short of doing what he did, we couldn't really pin it down very easily. So that's why we've got all that variational stuff there. But it was a nightmare. Okay, let's have a next one, please. So this is the stuff I was writing on the board is essentially summarized on this transparency. Oh, this, gosh, it's old technology coming into my brain, isn't it? On this picture. So this is more or less saying what I've just said. You could take a Lagrangian mapping of the point, and what I'm going to do really is think of mapping of lines. And so, but in order to map the lines, you've still got to map points, and so you have a mapping from the coordinate x to xl. Now, Paul and I are not totally happy about, or in total agreement about the description we've used below. I should say hell was Paul's idea. I thought it might be embarrassing to call it hell. Paul's reply was, well, it is hell, isn't it? Hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian. The terminology being used there is just adapted from the Lagrangian description, though you can criticize it. In the Lagrangian description, you'd refer to the original coordinate as the Lagrangian coordinate and the final position as the Lagrangian position. And so in the same sense, we're describing this hybrid Eulerian description as the original point of the fictitious flow being x, and the final point of the fictitious flow, which is the Hell coordinate, and the final position of the fictitious flow is the Hell position. And the way this subject works is you actually define properties of the flow at the Hell position. Properties of the flow are defined at that displaced point, but they're always functions of the original Hell coordinate. So the subject gets complicated because you've got to try and remember which coordinate you're talking about, where the object is that you're looking at is actually a physical object. And so at the end of the day, all our equations are telling you about things that are happening at the fictitious point, but they're actually in terms, which is the XL, whereas actually they're all functions of the X. So everything is aiming, in the Hell description, is aiming to get functions of the position XL in terms of X. I guess we'll move on. Now, I'm going through this at the beginning fairly slowly because the notation is an absolute quagmire. And we'll try and get the ideas clear. I've used this calligraphic D for the real material derivative because we're actually going to want to work with a different material derivative which looks like the usual material derivative later. So the way to think about this is perhaps in the following way. If you were to think of velocity from a Lagrangian point of view, then you would define the velocity at a point as the material derivative of that point, and formally you just take the material derivative of x and you'll get out the velocity, no big deal. But one does have to remember what that d by dt means. It means you're trying to follow the velocity big V, and you're asked, when you write down dx by dt, you're thinking of an x that is really a point that is moving with the fluid, obviously, because that's what's going to give you V. Now, the way we're going to work is that we want all our functions at this displaced position. We're going to be working with them. So we're using this terminology of psi L. I need a pointer, really, don't I? No pointer. No. It would help to have a pointer. Anything. There's a lot of electrical stuff there. I wouldn't trust me with an electric or one of those pointers with. Actually, we're not going very fast, are we? I'll have to speed up in a minute. Well, I didn't see the point in getting everywhere lost before we'd even started. Okay, thank you. Okay. Well, it looks easy at the moment, but you'll soon find once you start using this notation, you'll think, what the hell's going on? So we're using this L as an operator. It just looks a very sort of innocuous superscript, but it actually conveys a lot. It means you're actually evaluating the function psi at the position xL, and you're regarding it as a function of the position x. So, for example, one of the things that comes out immediately is you can define a reference velocity. And you do this in the following way. You can write in an analogous way to the velocity up there. You can take a material derivative of which is written this way in terms of velocity u, which you haven't defined yet, dot grad. Now, the velocity at the position x can be not at the position. This is what's so confusing about this. This doesn't mean the velocity at x at all. It means the velocity as calculated at xL. So the velocity at xL is, in some sense, the rate of movement of xL. It isn't that material derivative, it's another one with a different velocity. Now, I can't remember what was on the next one. Do we want to go there yet or not? Yeah, I think we probably do. Let's just bear with us for the moment. Let's just see where this is taking us. Supposing you've got your function psi of L, which is the function of psi at the position xL, which is defined in terms of little x. Suppose you want to take its gradient and you want to work out its ith component. First thing is just the definition, just the gradient of it. The next thing is you've got to remember that psi L is a function of xL, which is a function of x. So you use the chain rule. So you differentiate psi L with respect to x, L, and evaluate it at L, which is the last object. That last object is the psi L by the xL, and it's exactly the same as the psi by the x evaluated at xL. And then the chain rule says you've got to multiply that by the xL by the xj. And for the stuff we're doing, this sort of dyadic notation is quite helpful. We can write the previous line as a vector. Grad psi is grad xl dot grad psi. And that grad xl means you've got to think of the gradient operator as being the thing that acts first. It's acting on xl, and the contraction is between xl and the gradient, which is what the previous line says. The contraction is between the x, the vector you're differentiating, and the xl. So that's the gradient. You can work out the gradient of psi and relate it to the gradient of psi L and relate it to the gradient of psi as evaluated at xL. You can play the same game with the time derivative. You can differentiate psi L, and you've got psi, the xL is a function of t, and there's also a t there. So you've got to differentiate both things. You've got to keep the xL fixed and differentiate with t, and also remember that the xL is a function of t as well, so you have to, you again use the chain rule. You've got to differentiate the psi with respect to xL, and you've got to differentiate xL with respect to t. So the first of those objects, you're differentiating psi at fixed xL at t, which is the same as differentiating psi with respect to t at fixed xL. And then in the second one, we've just been through all this. That object there is in fact grad psi evaluated at L. So if you now consider what, in terms of the material derivative you've just defined, what the psi by the t is, it's just the combination of those two terms. That's just the definition of that material derivative. And now you substitute in the values that we've just calculated. There's the psi by the the psi L by dt is that and that, which is that and that, and then you've got the U dot grad, which is coming from that one at the end there. Now you can start combining this stuff together, because we just leave that one. The grab style is essentially going to, have I missed anything? Oh, I guess there's one more step there. We've done the same thing as up there. The U dot grad of that is, maybe I've said that. You've got the thing from up there goes in there. And then those two combine, you take out the grab psi L, and the bit that's left is how we've defined VL. So in this way, this is all derivatives at X, but they refer to values at L. This is the psi by dt as evaluated L, that's V as evaluated L, that's grab psi as evaluated L, which is the same as the ordinary material derivative as evaluated at L. So what we've shown, whose head is it? Who's the criminal? So what we've actually shown is that the this establishes the equivalence of if you want to write the material derivative of your function at L, then you can write as d by dt of psi L in terms of the velocity u that we've introduced. Okay, so what this means, supposing, for example, your psi was frozen to your flow V, then your psi L is frozen to your flow little u. So that's if you have a situation where these quantities vanish. So this means that the velocity u has some sort of meaning. It's not that easy to see what it is, actually. The velocity... Yeah, nothing more at the moment. No, nothing very profound. So, let's see, what have we done? The rubber. Oh, that's the rubber. So, I actually have a horrible feeling. Is this on the next transparency? No. The x by dt, which is d by dt of x plus u dot grad of x, is just u. What you have is that this is the same as I'm already in a muddle. That's the x by dt. Oh right, that's the velocity u. I didn't want to do it this way round, did I? I think I'm being premature. It is on the next transparency, so why am I doing it like this? I don't need to do this. It's all on the next transparency. Yeah, let's go to the next transparency. Right. Right, the x by dt is the velocity, so let's calculate the velocity at xl, and that gives you vl, and I guess what, it's the thing at the bottom here that's the point, really. I mean, to get a feeling for what u is, it isn't good, is it? V at L, yeah, okay. Take this operator over to the other side. Multiply this thing by dx KL by DXL, so you've got the U dot grad, you've got the U dot grad X. So VL is dx by dt plus U dot grad X. It's just take that formula, multiply it by, contract it with, contract it with that. And by this device, you begin to see what the little u is. It's complicated. It's a complicated object. However, the other way of thinking about this is that as you had it before, VL, yes, I'm getting myself in the right model here. This VL is dxl by dt plus u dot grad x. So the VL is made up partly of dxl by dt. Yeah, that's the thing, the first thing you've got to focus on. Dxl by dt is the velocity of the fictitious particle. So the fictitious particle is moving around. Then what you need to do is subtract off that fictitious motion from the real motion, and what's left is related to u. And it's not related to u in a simple way. It involves the coordinate transformation. But u really does represent, in some loose sense, the velocity difference between the actual velocity and the velocity of the reference particle, which is sort of wobbling around. Okay, now we're just developing a bit of the apparatus now. Oh, well, we haven't got that far yet. Just wait. We haven't got that far. Right. Now, anticipating we're going to want to play some games with the equation of motion, I thought at this stage it might be helpful to see some vector identities. Now, if you take the material, the d by dt derivative of grad x, you can commute these operations. You've got to be very careful about this. You want to bring that inside, and that will give you d by dt of xl, which is vl, gradient of vl. So if you bring that inside, you'd actually get that dxl by dt is vl. But if you do that, you've got to watch it, because the d by dt has got a u dot grad. So when you bring it inside, you've got to differentiate the u dot grad, and that's the term on the other side. Now, I've written it in a funny way, because what I've done is I've said we've got to take the gradient of u, and it'll be actually dotted with that gradient of xl. So there is that thing that sort of integrates by parts, or bringing the u inside the gradient leaves you with something left over. Now, this velocity here is absolutely crucial to what we do. I've written it up there, but this velocity, you remember what it means? It means the contraction is on the XL and the VL, and that's what's written down here. And you'll notice at this stage already that the two key velocities that come into the theory have a different structure. The little u, which is like a convective velocity, is a contravariant version of that vector, whereas the big V is a covariant version of the velocity V. So the subject is beginning to get a little bit wild. We've already got two velocities when we originally had one. Now, this velocity V, and this is the reason for the momentum for freedom momentum, it's this velocity big V that eventually plays the role of momentum in the equation of motion. And this is the key part that is momentum. So when I say momentum plus pseudo-momentum, you'd have to take off the velocity V. Well, actually, remember this is the velocity at the XL. So you'd have to take off the velocity at XL to get the actual momentum at XL. So in that sense, this V, or rho V, density times that velocity, is the momentum at the point XL plus the what we'd refer to as the pseudo-momentum at the point XL. So it's a bit premature to bring this terminology in, but we've introduced the vector, so it might be as well to have a feeling for what it's about. Right, so how do you... Okay, we'll move on to the next one. So how do you deal with Euler's equation? We'll write Euler's equation in this primitive form. for an incompressible fluid, constant density fluid, you see the simplest case. And notice that the equation involves a gradient. So if we want to go to the XL position, we need to transform this equation. We don't want to stick with the gradient. By the time we transform the gradient, it will be a mess. So what we actually want is to get the gradient at the new position, at the XL. We want in order to get it written as a gradient of P over rho evaluated at L, that's the objective. We want to write that as gradient of P over rho evaluated at L. We want to realize that gradient of P evaluated at L is actually that combination. And we've worked out these gradients before. So bearing that in mind, what you've got to do with Euler's equation to preserve the property of the gradient is you've got to contract the expression for Euler's equation with grad XL. So the starting point in manipulating Euler's equation is to realize that you need to construct a new vector E, which is grad XL dot EL. That's how you do it. Now, the next trick to get nice equations is to write this E in a slightly different form. You actually, and this is all built in because of these funny contractions which are going on, you actually want to write down a combination of dV by dt and grad V dot V. So we'll split that off, and then this grad V dot V is nothing very profound, it's just gradient of a half V squared. So we'll take that gradient of a half V squared and subtract it off the gradient of P over rho. So we write that as grad pi, which involves subtracting off the half rho, the half V squared. Now the next trick is to get the E. So you form the contraction with this object on both those two terms and write it in the form as it's written at the bottom there. Now, the gradient, as I say, the gradient transforms nicely. We knew that. That's where we started off from. So that's not a big deal. The next deal is how do you calculate the grad XL dot AL. That's what we need to do next. Yes. Move on. Well, the pi, that's what the superscript L means. It means they're evaluated with XL. The general, that's the definition of pi. The superscript L tells you where it's evaluated. So I'll skim through how this works. I won't go through the gory details, all the gory, just some of them. So you want to contract that object with grad XL. And this is why we did the calculation earlier, because we want to bring that inside the derivative. So we do need the derivative of grad XL. So let's see. Some of these terms go through like a charm. That contracted with that just means that the... I don't like that. All right. I get these nightmares every time I look at this stuff. Should the L be outside the brackets? I think it should, shouldn't it? I think that's a typo. Yeah, sorry, that's my mistake. There's a typo. This is the acceleration combination evaluated at L. So that L should be outside the brackets. You then bring the L onto both the gradient and the V, and the gradient with the L on goes out with that, leaving you with that. that is a typo. The L should be outside. So you've reduced that one to that form. You can manipulate this lot using that identity that we got earlier, and you then can finish up with the acceleration or the combination of that and that as transformed as that. That's the nice thing. And the combination of the u dot grad and the grad u dot v turn out to be a very useful combination. We've written this in terms of curly brackets. We've got criticized immediately by Darrell saying curly brackets is used for Poisson brackets. So you shouldn't be using curly brackets, but he has some most horrendous symbols that seems a bit unnecessary. So we've used the curly bracket. Oh, we use square brackets for something else. Well, we use the square brackets for something else. Yes. Sorry, which line are we talking about? Down here. Yeah. There's no linearization, those are exact equations. Oh yeah, it's complicated. It's complicated.
Okay.
Yeah, they're related all right. if you go back to the previous, when I described one vector as covariant, the other contravariant, they're all linked to that stage. They're all linked, yes. I mean, there's a one real velocity v, and from it you can describe, in terms of the displacement, you can define two new vectors. So you've gone from one vector to two new vectors. But the idea, you can see what the spirit of this equation is. You've got a form of Euler's equation in which the momentum V has now been replaced by the momentum big V. That's the spirit of it. So that's how this material works. There's a little bit more that you can do with this stuff. I guess we'll move on to the next one, yeah? And this is really the thing that in Darrell's stuff he gets very excited about, it's the circulation. And it's due to the nice things really stem from the transformation properties of the big V and the little V. If you form dx dot V and evaluate it at XL, that's the dx at XL and the V at XL. The dx at XL is dx dot grad XL. Then you reorganize the brackets, you put the brackets around the last two. So the dxl dot grad v is the big V, and then you've just left the dx. So the dx dot v at the fictitious position is dx dot big V. So if you were to consider the material derivative of v dot dx, you've got to do, it's quite easy to show, you've got to write down what the material derivative of a little dx is, of course. But at the end of the day, and this is where that combination of the acceleration and the extra term comes in handy, this just simplifies to a dot dx, which is a is minus grad pi. So if you dot the grad pi with dx, you get d pi. And likewise, what we've just shown is that directly from Euler's equation is that the other material derivative involving the convective velocity u of v dot dx is a dot dx, which is minus pi dl. Now, the notation is getting a little, I didn't know what the best way forward here is, but you could put L's on everything. You can ask, well, not, I suppose you can't really at that stage. If you now consider a material loop, let's just think of the first one. You think of a material loop moving with the fluid, then you could think of this as being evaluated at XL on a line at XL, and that is a line moving with the fluid. And then you, on the one hand, you have Kelvin circulation theorem that tells you that that vanishes. That's just saying that the circulation around the loop doesn't change. On the other hand, if you do the material derivative of v dot dx around a loop which comes from the mapping of the point x to xl, then the material derivative of that, because the material derivative there is moving in the x coordinate system, it's not moving in the XL coordinate system. That d by dt refers to motion in that space. So the material derivative of v dot dx is zero. And this is the nice thing. This is, you've got preservation of circulation in the context of the big V. So that's where all this stuff takes you. You can do a bit more. You can take averages of this stuff. And I guess for the first time we'll mention explicitly a displacement. We'll call it xi. So if you calculate the velocity, it's dxl by dt, which is u plus dxi by dt. So in that sense, the I have a horrible feeling about the subscripts again. This should be x superscript. That should be xl, shouldn't it? That should be xl. The velocity at xl is dxl by dt. We've been a bit naughty. The velocity at xl, that should be the velocity at xl, is u plus dxi by dt. Now, the nice thing about this is if you want to go take averages, you can put all the mean stuff into u and all the fluctuating stuff into the xi. So you can demand that the average of u is u, the average of u is u, and the average of xi is zero. And once you've done that, we've got it right here. That's not the same as that, is it? VL is V at XL, there's an XL missing. So V at L is the average of that u plus V at L is u, which is mean u, xi by dt plus u dot grad xi. So, with the average of xi vanishing, you can average this equation. The average of the velocity at the fictitious point is actually the same as the average of the velocity u. So this gives you a nice interpretation. The average following these displaced particles, the fictitious flow, the average of the velocity at that point is u. Right. You can then average Euler's equation and you get a nice form for it, because you don't get any cross terms, because the uv that appears there, the u is itself a mean quantity. So what you actually have to deal with when you average Euler's equation is the average of the pseudo-momentum, and you have a convective velocity. So the equation comes through very nicely. Circulation is also preserved. All the arguments about circulation before still carry through for this equation. So the nice thing about this system is that the thing that always plagues all averaging problems, that you have something like a divergence of a Reynolds stress that you have to average. You don't have that. Okay. Right, now that's the Hell description. And in fact, that was really a refresher, because of course that stuff's been known for years. And so that was just a little lesson. What we want to do with this, or what Holmes' idea was, to say, well, we don't like having to work at different positions. The thing that plagues the stuff is your coordinate is little x, and everything you're talking about is happening somewhere else. You're talking about a point, but you're really talking about, you have everything defined in terms of some point, but everything you're talking about is happening elsewhere. So why can't we have all our variables defining things at the point of interest? So to do this, you've got to expand everything. Now, if you were to go through what we've done already and start thinking of psi as being a small quantity, then you can relate the psi L to the psi. You can do Taylor series expansions, and you can relate psi at the displaced point to the value of psi at the original point. So this gives you a mechanism for getting from psi L to psi at x itself. And you can invert this, you can write this the other way around. You can write psi equals psi L minus that, and then you put the first approximation for that in, which is itself psi L. And so you can invert this and get going and go on as far as you like. You can invert this process. So you can write psi in terms of the value at the displaced point. Right, the first problem you have is that your velocity, VL, is defined at the displaced, is defined at x, but it actually tells you about the velocity at xl. We'd really like to get the velocity at x itself. So what do you do? You put in the velocity, you take this Taylor expansion, or this one, you write you replace the psi by V, you ask what the value of V is, you want the value of V at the Lagrangian point, at the displaced point, and that's U plus the psi by dt, and then you have to subtract off that. I'm just keeping terms up to order xi. And so you can write the V at the actual position x as U plus the psi by dt plus, here's our square bracket. Very useful object, these square brackets. I didn't realize how useful they were till we did this stuff. You write that as that's the u dot grad psi, it's coming from there, minus the psi dot grad u. So you can write the velocity in this form. Now all this is saying, it looks rather complicated, but it's really rather simple. And it's what you'd expect. First of all, let's forget about the mean flow. First order, you'd expect the velocity at the displaced point to be just xi by dt. That's what you do when you do linear water waves. You don't worry about the fact you've displaced the point and so on, but you can think of xi as being the displacement of the fluid and so on when you're doing water waves, and you just write it down as xi by dt. What you've got here is you're saying that the velocity at x is the velocity at the displaced point. That's the V at XL. But of course, we're evaluating this at the wrong place. This is at XL, and we should have evaluated it at X. So what we need to do is subtract off what happens when you move back a bit. So what you've got to do is take off the rate of change of U as you go through a displacement size. So all this is telling, this extra term is telling you, is the fact that the velocity you've calculated here isn't the velocity at X, but it's at XL. So you need to take off the bit that's corresponding to the change of the basic velocity between the two points. So this just accounts for the fact that the flow u is actually varying with position, so you need to remove that to get back to the velocity at x. Now, as I say, this is all well known. This sort of people doing waves write this sort of stuff on mean flows, write this down all the time. And I think the first time I saw it, Paul pointed out a paper to me by some guys, Freeman and Rosenberg, who've been doing this stuff in plasma physics years ago. It's nothing new in this. This is well known. Sorry? Yeah. Bohm kept telling us we should have called us. First time he looked at our paper, he said, there's no mention of Lie algebra. This would do the biggest service to JFM ever, no mention of Lie algebra. Right. Well, we don't have to worry about it. No. In fact, it isn't. In its most useful form, it isn't. We're fortunate. I kept worrying about density in this presentation, but we don't actually have to worry about it at any point. Because the density itself is constant. That's a very good point. The transformation doesn't preserve volume necessarily. In normally, the most useful forms, probably it doesn't. Well, it's certainly not uniquely defined. You need around the Goethe. Well, once you take averages, that might start to make to specify things. So at this point, where you've got ambiguity. You've got two things. You've got a xi and a u. You've got two things. So you're defining a vector with three components with a quantity which involves six components. So it's not unique. I mean, I can choose xi to be naught, for example. And I could, and that would get you back to the Eulerian flow. I could choose u to be naught, and then be back to the Lagrangian flow. So you've got complete flexibility. It's not unique. Right, now where's this taking us? You could go this way, and you can expand everything out in the Hell stuff in this form. You need to go to the next order. But, let's see. Yeah, I guess we need to go one more remark. I guess the remark at the bottom here is worth making first. If you can naturally split V into its mean and fluctuating parts, and certainly to order xi at any rate, the u would be the mean flow, and the v prime would be the xi by dt plus u dot grad xi. But importantly, you'll notice there are actually errors in this representation. This is just taking the series up toward xi. So this is within this Hell framework. This is only an approximation up toward xi. Now, this result, in a sense, provides Home with his motivation for how you go next. He said, okay, let's split our velocity up into two bits, and we'll take a mean velocity, and the fluctuating velocity will essentially be defined in this way, where you don't actually have any, it's a bit unclear about this, but what we want to do is to take this representation as our starting point. So to do that as our starting point without any error terms, we're going to have to introduce a new vector, because it's not going to be the same as this vector. It's almost the same, but it's not quite. So what we're going to do next is to use this type of representation based on this idea, but without the error terms. So I guess we go to the next one. Right, so I say our variant of the Home approach because he keeps chopping and changing and you're never quite sure what's going on. So we've tried to keep, this is our interpretation of what he's doing, I suppose. You write V as a mean part, well no, a V bar. And very important, at this stage V bar isn't necessarily the mean velocity. It's just a decomposition of the velocity. You've got a V bar and a V prime, which are motivated by the expansions we've just looked at. The reason we called it V bar at this stage is because we don't want to have to introduce yet more notation later. But at this stage it's just any old velocity. So this is just any old velocity decomposition. And then you write you have a V bar and you have a V prime. Now I say this relation is exact. This is slightly confusing as to what this means. What this really means is just to say this is the definition of V prime. This is its definition. V prime is related to another vector, zeta, by that formula. Oh gosh, I'm muddling up. We are going here. This is a bit premature. I just said we're not saying averages, and then I put the zeta bar equal to naught. Forget that one, that was premature. Ignore it. Ignore the zeta bar equal to naught. We haven't done mean anything yet because we've not defined the bar. Sorry, that is just confusing you. V bar, at this stage, eventually V bar is going to be the average of V, and xi bar is going to be the average of xi, and xi is going to have zero mean part, just as in the previous stuff. Right. So the philosophy at this stage is that, we can relate this representation to the previous one, and we can relate the V's to the xi. Now, I guess at this stage it's not, I say in the determinist, we can do it, we can determine them, but it's not unique actually. It's not unique till we actually define the bars. But if you do the obvious things and relate them in the obvious ways, the V bar can be related to U, the zeta can be related to xi, but there are errors at order xi squared. Right, now, this is our one brief excursion into the variational method. The way this is done, the variational approach is done, is something along the following lines. Normally, you'd have P as a thermodynamic quantity in this relation, and you can't do this trick at the end here, but basically, P is in some sense more like a Lagrange multiplier in this context as we're treating rho as a constant. So our idea is that rho is a constant, we're dealing with constant density fluids. And the variational methods are based on considering the integral of half rho v squared along trajectories of the flow, and of the real flow. And variations are then done subject to the particle paths over some space-time integral. Now, as far as we can see, because the equations he gets are done essentially, all his approximations agree with the approximations we make, but the point at which it seems to go wrong is in the following sense. Normally when you do the variation of this Lagrangian, you obviously got to vary the particle paths. And you can do this in one of two ways. You can either think of the delta V prime as being fixed, and you vary the delta V, and of course that delta V bar is corresponds to delta V, or you can keep the V bar as fixed, and you can vary the V prime. You can do it one way or the other, and both will give out the correct forms of Euler's equation. Now, having adopted this representation for V prime, Home essentially varies, does a variation of V bar, and keeps the zeta fixed. But once you do that, you're in trouble, because if you keep zeta fixed rather than V prime, that formula up there forces a V prime. If you vary V prime, you've actually forced the V prime. So as a result of this, having done a variation with respect to V bar, you don't actually have the incremented velocity isn't actually the real incremented velocity, and this seems to be the source of the missing term. Certainly when we did it through the variational procedures and you write down the various variational derivatives, he doesn't have any variational derivative which involves a variation with respect to zeta. And when we did this, we took into careful account the fact that you do have to worry about variation of zeta, and you get another term involving a functional derivative with respect to zeta. So that's where the discrepancies with approaches arise. Okay. Right, so what's the parallel development using the representation for the velocity we've just described? Well, it actually parallels the Hell approach. It doesn't look quite like that at this stage, but it is. Now let's see, what you're going to do, this object here is a bit like the contraction of grad x with e. Grad x is one identity matrix, that gives you the first term. Grad of the displacement, well that's the grad of psi dotted with zeta, which is part of that. There's also a zeta dot grad e in that, and that amounts to moving yourself back. We've come across that in some of the other things. So you've got to, this E, the E is evaluated, remember the E here is evaluated as X, but to get to the Hell thing, you needed to evaluate the stuff at the displaced point. So you've got to add on what happens when you move E to the new point. So you've got to add on a xi dot grad E, and that's a zeta dot grad E, and that's what's in the second term. So when you actually want to evaluate E at the displaced point, which is what we did in the previous stuff, you need to evaluate E at the displaced point, and that would be in lowest order at any rate, the E plus zeta dot grad eta, grad curly E, and then you've got also the fact that you've got that contraction with the gradient of the displacement. So that's where it's coming from. It's beginning to, it looks very much like the Hell stuff, but you're actually having to remember that you've also got to make a displacement as well. So we transform everything in this way. We transform V in the same way. So that gives you a V, which is a little bit like the big V we had before. We decompose the A into the two, well, we keep the A that we had before. We keep the grad pi that we had before. We define EA in the, EE, we've done that. EE is made up of this operator acting on, A is made up of that operator acting on A, which is that one. Grad P is made up of that operator acting on grad P. Now that combination actually turns into grad E. This is a result. That's the object you've constructed. But this quantity can be written as the gradient of E where pi E where the pi E is that. So that is a result. You can write that combination as grad pi E. So the only thing left to do is to handle this term. Right. So let's just go through this. This is, in a sense, the crucial step. So you need to calculate what AE is. So let's go through the terms. A is composed of those two bits. So let's apply this combination operators on the dV by dt. So there's the dV by dt. There's the zeta dV by dt. Then we apply the operator on the V, comma V. That's this one, which is the first bit, and then there's that, which is the second bit. Right, now you start recombining these things in certain ways. You bring out that d by dt outside the curly bracket. And then you can combine it with that to give you that. So bringing the d by dt outside gives you the first term. Having done that, you've got to subtract off d zeta by dt. What's left there is quite nice. You can write v as v bar plus d zeta by dt plus v bar comma zeta in the square brackets. So we've done that. So that v has gone to v bar, the d zeta by dt's have gone, and we're left with that. And now this is where all the Lie algebra comes into its own, or formulas. Well, we had to invent these. We reinvented Lie algebra here, and we got some lovely formulas. And you can one of the results. It's when you have these triple quantities. The square brackets are rather nice. You get a square bracket of an a, and then a square bracket of a b and a c, and then you cyclic commute the a, b, and c, and add them together, it vanishes. And this is a key Lie algebra property. And that's actually used in getting this result here. But you can reorganize this stuff and write it in this form that's just gone through. This stuff reorganizes to give you that and that. So your Euler's equation now becomes this one at the bottom. That's the one, yeah. Rediscovered it. And it was hard work. The number of times we did these partial derivatives, they're terrible. Once we discovered it, everything really fell into place. Now, this is the final equation. And this is really the hub of the whole story. Do I want to go to the next one? Let me just see what I've got here. I don't want to move on and then come back. No, I think we want to ponder here for a moment. Because this, if you didn't have that term, that's basically the equation home derived. She doesn't get that term. That term's missing. And as I say, we get that term. We go from a variational point of view. You get this term by allowing, you get the first terms by essentially allowing for variations with respect to V-bar. And the last term comes about from varying something or other, varying the pressure or density or something. You've got to let the density vary in this variational approach. That's why you have the P comes in as a Lagrange multiplier. So you have a D by D rho sort of operator there and a D by D V operator there. But to get that one, you need to do a D by D zeta sort of trick. So, and that, he never has that term. So this equation is exact. Now I talked, and some of you were at Boulder when I talked about this 2 years ago. And in fact, we'd done everything in terms of expansions at that stage. And we'd identified something like this term, but it was all part of a power series expansion. And we have a referee to thank for this. And when the referee saw the paper, he said, yes, but you should go to higher order. You obviously haven't gone far enough. And we thought, well, if it doesn't work at this order, it's not going to get any better when we go any further. So we thought we'd been set an impossible task until we realized that we could actually write this essentially to all orders. This is an exact statement. There's no approximation. This is an exact result. Yeah, that's the objective. You don't get a closed equation for V. And in fact, what you've got here is an extra term which is as bad as Reynolds stress type of term. It's the same. It's got the same status from a mathematical point of view. You've got an extra term there which involves, I mean, the object now is to take averages, of course. You're going to take averages, you're going to write dv bar by dt. You're going to do exactly what we did with the home, with the hell stuff. You're going to do exactly the same. And everything is fine if you didn't have that term. Well, why would you neglect? Yeah, but why would you neglect the divergence of v prime average? Under some conditions. Small amplitude. Yeah, no, you're quite right. If there was a reasonable reason for neglecting it. But the point is that as far as we can see, there's no reason to neglect this term. And that's really our message. I guess we do a bit more. The averages. I mean, that's the whole point of the exercise. You average the stuff, you get an extra term. For material circuits, etc., etc., you can write down a Kelvin thing, but you've got an extra term. You've broken Kelvin, yeah. So the Kelvin for this V bar E, you don't have a Kelvin circulation theorem. What I've said here is, that's just what I've said. Let's move on to the next one, I guess. Right. Now, we thought we ought to say something about alpha, Holmes alpha, seeing as that was the title of the talk. And what I want to do, we want to do here, is just show you a little bit about how it comes into the game. If you're dealing with this VE bar, it's actually composed of two bits. Three bits. There's the average of V, then there's the quadratic of the fluctuating stuff, which essentially is, this is a combination of the curly bracket stuff, the xi v and the xi v. It's the two xi v terms in the curly brackets. But these are the fluctuating bits. So average, the product of the fluctuating bits average. Now, if you think of v e as being the total momentum of the system in some sense, then the pseudo momentum would be the difference of v e and v bar, which is the sum of those two. Now, when actually Holmes calculates his alpha coefficient, he makes a number of different hypotheses, but the one that seems to be his key one, which is stated here, is the statement that this zeta quantity is affected with the mean flow. So you make the assumption right at the word go that the material derivative in this with respect to the V-bar vanishes. And that means, of course, that, because V primed is that minus that. So once you've got that term to vanish, V primed is just zeta dot grad V bar. The other thing that follows from this is if you form a correlation zeta I, zeta j, and average it and differentiate it, you'll get, and then use that identity, you will get it to vanish, and of course you can average it afterwards. So you've actually got that. And he then makes the proposal, well, one solution would be that this zeta j, ij is essentially a constant. It can be isotropic. It's something that is a function of, it's alpha squared times something, and alpha is a scalar affected with the mean flow. So that's his basic assumption. Now, if you look at the Vs that appears there as defined by that, you can, you put the V prime given by that into that formula, and you'll have minus zeta dot grad all squared acting on V bar. And then you bring one of the zetas inside, for the first of those operations, you bring the zeta inside. But having done that, you've then got to differentiate it again, so that's where it's a J there, and there's a, the J goes with that and with that, so the gradient operator goes with the zeta J, so that gives you the div zeta. And if you assume it's incompressible to the first order, that div zeta, to that order, the div zeta vanishes, so you don't have that term, you just have the divergence of that, which is the divergence of minus alpha squared V. So that is from just going through this type of calculation, that's the source of the alpha term. Where this stuff starts to fall apart a little bit is that in fact there's another term, there's a VP. And in fact, if you read Holmes' paper, you actually suddenly discover that this is actually referred to as the pseudo momentum. It's actually the whole of that. And you say, well, where's this come from? And then you realize when he's actually got this term, he's actually not done it this way at this stage. He's gone back to a variational principle and done what he tends to do classically, which is instead of having a V squared, he has a V squared plus alpha grad V, and he varies all that stuff, and then this term naturally comes out. But he then calls it the pseudo-momentum. But in fact, if you've done it this way, you've actually got an extra term. But that's the source of the pseudo-momentum. I guess we're just about finished, aren't we, now? Let's move on to the next one. So the VE is just composed of those differences with the extra term, blah, blah, blah. And if you make the Holmes approximation of dropping the extra, he didn't call it an approximation, but if you ignore the term we've discovered, that you get that, and also if you ignore the VP average, you get that. So there are two terms gone. So that's the source of the Navier-Stokes alpha equations, and I guess we just move on to a summary. We've been here talking long enough. I think we just finish off now. So the conclusions are basically the following. You could, if you took Euler's equation and averaged it, you would write down an equation of that form. If you took our version of Holmes' equations, you'd write that down. And Holmes actually drops that. And then, this is again coming back to the question that's been asked, it's not obvious that dropping that's any better or worse than dropping that, which is what you... I mean, that's the analogy. If you wanted to simplify the first equation, you'd have to drop that. If you wanted to simplify the second equation, you'd have to drop that. And it's not obvious that this is a useful way forward. The other feature is that the E-bar doesn't possess any nice mean circulation properties. And I guess our basic message, if you want to play this game, you go back to hell. That's the right way. That's it. Yes. Conservation of energy. Oh, gosh. Oh, that would be a mess. You can, it is V squared, or it could be, you've raised a very interesting point, which we didn't want to get onto. There's a covariant and contravariant transformation of the velocity. And I never know which is which. But the one we did, the big V, is a big V which we got. And we got a little U, but that involved taking off the, psi by dt. If you didn't take off the psi by dt and just transform the velocity in that way, you get perhaps another V. And the energy could be formed with a contraction of those two V's. The covariant and contravariant versions of V can be contracted together to give you the energy. Or you can just leave it as V squared. But if you want to use the new notation, it would be involved with V, the big V, and a little V, which we never actually introduced here. A little V, which is a constant. I think Paul always tells me it's obvious, but I'm simple. I'll never find it now, will I? But that's the answer to your question. You can write in terms of big V, but you'd need another velocity. You know what I'm saying? I've put it on the board. Maybe just go back to the transparency. It's the early one, wasn't it? About 3 or 4 or 5, isn't it? Well, that's the one. Yeah. If you didn't have that term, you could define yet another velocity. And if you wanted to form V squared at L, it'd be the contraction of those two velocities. That's all I'm saying. But we haven't. There's nothing we do which involves that. There's nothing we do which involves this product. It does appear in other contexts. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, this certainly when you're doing MHD and you're trying to deal with the magnetic field, you certainly want that quantity. The Lorentz force transforms in a nasty way. The induction equation is nice. Without dissipation, of course. The induction equation is nice. The problem with this game is you introduce, once you make these transformations, you suddenly find yourself having to live with two vectors instead of one. And in fact, in a sense, that's where Holmes comes in from, in a sense. He says you've got to relate two vectors. And everything he does is asking how this V is related to that U, in a sense. That's the way he's going. But in more complicated situations, you do have to worry about the contravariant versions of the velocity. You certainly have to do this for the magnetic field. You need the covariant and contravariant versions of the magnetic field. What are you trying to deal with? Well, in the induction equation, you only need the contravariant version of the magnetic field. Induction equation, you have something like a U. You have the U and you have a B, which is defined in a similar way, and that's without that. So, you have a contravariant B in the magnetic induction equation. But when you go to the Lorentz force, you'll actually need covariant and contravariant forms of B.
Covariant
Yeah, if you run, if you mount the, you, to get V squared, you have to multiply the covariant with the contravariant vector. Yeah. Possibly. I don't know the answers to those questions.
I mean, that's something
that's necessary to make practical use of this. Well, as far as I mean, it always seems to me that I have a nasty feeling about this. If in some sense the VL is nasty and the U is meant to be nice, you have this horrible feeling that the V up here is going to be even worse. This one here. Oh, God knows where the thing is he's given me. So it's that. This equation is basically a consequence of that one. Once you've written that down, this follows. I mean, I can't even picture how this works. I mean, it's a bizarre approximation to my way of thinking. I don't know what you think. It just says that the displacement is frozen. Sort of have this feeling of these freezer displacement, nothing happens. But obviously something happens. You, there are consequences. The reason why you're running into trouble with this works out well with the VS. So it won't work out well with the VP. You've got gradients of zeta, and you can't relate the product of the zeta and the gradient of zeta to that quantity. You can't relate these things. You've got more than one quantity in those equations. You might have one quantity alpha. You really need a quantity beta or something as well. There's more than one turbulent average involved in the representation up there. There's more than one. Yeah.
The problem with Lagrangian approach is sooner or later you run into viscosity problem. Or with this different type of what happens if I introduce a small viscosity?
Well, I mean, the idea
where
is...
Where will be broken?
Well, the idea is that that's supposed to happen on the even smaller scales. This is supposed to be at a scale intermediate. I mean, you're dealing with Euler's equation on the basis that you're still on a scale on which the viscous effects are unimportant. You're quite right, if the scale drops down, then you need the viscosity. But one's really interested in an intermediate scale here. It's perhaps below one you can resolve numerically, but one which is still above the So this is length then, isn't it? Am I right? And is that the interpretation?
Well, yeah, but it's time. You can keep this medium scale all the time. I'm thinking about evolution. You go on and on, and scales become smaller and smaller.
Well, you can't address that with this. You can put viscosity in, but that's only on the mean flow. Yeah. Well, when glass. Yeah. We haven't got. I mean, well, it's not really addressing that. I mean, what Home would do would be to actually put the viscous term in on the large length scale. None of it. Right. On the small scales as well?
Yeah.
Oh. It's very nice, yes. Oh golly, because I really want to move the screen up because I need to write something on the board, don't I? That's why I'm trying to find the formula, but it's, these pages are going to take some sorting, aren't they? Yeah, okay.
The way you deal with the induction equation is, you need to, let's see, you've written VL is DT of X, or XL, plus U dot grad of XL. And I guess you do the same with B. You'd write B at L as B dot grad XL. And if you do that, the induction equation for a frozen field would be B by dt plus curl equals curl of U of V cross B. Now what do? You put this all at the L point, and then you've got to contract this in some way, haven't you? I guess you've got to contract it. That's the inverse, isn't it? You've got to contract that with dx by dxL. I think that's what you do. God knows where the contraction is. I don't know which one you're doing on which, but the upshot of all that is you can rewrite that as dB by dt plus equals curl of U cross B. That's all that happens. That's all that happens. Well, it's the same as the advection of the scalar quantity, which came in at the very beginning. It means that if you relate the B at the displaced point to, if you like, a fictitious B, I mean, just as the U was fictitious, this is a fictitious B, just as that U is fictitious, it's only defined as this equation defines it, this B is only defined as this equation defines it. This tells you that, what it's saying is your BL is a frozen vector field. VL is a frozen vector field, frozen to the flow VL. And all this is saying is that the vector field B is frozen to flow U, just as the psi is frozen to the flow V, then psi L is frozen to the flow U. That's all. It's just a statement of frozen field.
What?
Oh, golly. No. Well, that's the beauty of it. You've taken it out. There's nothing left over. That's exact. That's exact. So the question is whether B, yeah, that's the issue, I suppose, whether you're assuming that U is equal to U bar, but you can't necessarily assume that B is equal to B bar. It doesn't follow that way. That's quite true once you start, well, be careful about this. No, that's not quite true. If you start off with a B that was mean, it would stay mean. That's quite correct. Yeah, if you only have a mean field to start with, and you have a mean B to start with, you always only have a mean B. Divergence occurs at the level I've talked about, because he obtains his equations from variational principles. This is where the problems all stem from. I don't think he has a variational problem for the scalar. I'm not quite sure what he is. Yeah. Well, that's what we've done, isn't it? And that's what we're doing. Well, I guess we are sort of working on. I think we're actually working on this, actually. It's a good idea, but I think we've, in some sense, I think we're always, our feeling is that Holmes' objective is a nice one. You get everything in terms of objects at the original point, and you're dealing with objects at the original point, and we're just, one of the things we're doing is trying to do it properly. In some sense. I think you're going to have this problem in all problems. It's just unique in that, like Andrews McIntyre approach, you do that, you can write down exact statements, but I don't think you can for anything else. It's just the one case you can do it.
Is there a wheel of a
Well, if something's being convected and is invariant, you, at the end of the day, it's with origin in nature, isn't it? You can't get away from that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I would tend to think of it more as an ensemble average, I would have thought. I mean, if you take time averages, you're then back to a can of worms again, aren't you, I would have thought. You're averaging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you run different groups.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the short answer.